testing for COVID-19 is still not widely available, and the tests that are out there may not be as accurate as we'd hoped.
Patients who present with classic symptoms are testing negative, and we're retesting them and are finding positives on our subsequent testing.
I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway, for Wednesday, April 15th, a look at how false negative testing may understate the scale of this pandemic. Also, how some state policies may prevent people with disabilities from accessing life-saving care.
Basically, if you have an intellectual disability, there is a fear that you are therefore put down in the list of the people that Washington would be willing to save if they run out of ventilators.
And we're talking the new FX show Mrs. America and the struggle between progressive and conservative activists in the 1970s.
Every time we take a step forward and there's a social revolution, there's always a counter-revolution, there's always a backlash. And if we don't really understand the roots of the backlash, I don't think our social revolutions will be very successful.
First up, where are we with testing? You've been hearing for weeks that there's a shortage of COVID-19 tests across the country, and this shortage is not allowing us to see the full scale of the pandemic. But the tests that are being administered may also be contributing to an undercount of COVID-19 cases. Medical professionals are reporting that the most common type of test is providing false negative results, meaning people are testing negative for the disease when they're actually positive. These tests are administered by a medical professional, and they push a swab through your nose way into the back of your throat. And it's pretty uncomfortable. Trust me, I know I had symptoms the second week of March, and because I'm higher risk, I'm pregnant, and I have an autoimmune disease, I got a test from my primary care doctor. And they really shove that swab up there, and it hurts. I am okay, by the way. I ended up having the flu. As for the overall testing efficacy, one widely cited study from China reports that up to 1 in 3 people given the test can turn up a false negative result. And this can be a problem because people who believe they may not have it can spread the illness to others, and it prevents us from accurately tracing its spread. I spoke with Dr. Priya Sampath-Kumar about this. She's the medical director of infection prevention and control at the Mayo Clinic. I also spoke with Dr. Danielle Ofri, an attending physician at Bellevue Hospital and a clinical professor of medicine at the NYU School of Medicine. They told us that the false negative results aren't necessarily about the accuracy of the test, but a host of other factors, including best practices for administering it. I asked Dr. Ofri to describe what this common test looks like and how they're administered.
So we're using the PCR test, which is looking at the RNA of the virus, and we do it with a nasopharyngeal swab, which is a Q-tip that goes in the nose way, way back to the throat. And we've had a few variations on the test of where we send it, different outside labs. We also do an in-house test, and the turnaround time varies depending on where the sample is processed.
Have you or other doctors had patients where you suspect you got a false negative, or maybe they tested positive after initially getting a negative test?
At this point, I would say early in the pandemic, it was more of an issue. Now, when the patients have the symptoms, we treat them as though it's COVID, no matter what the test shows. And it's almost not necessary other than keeping track. It's more of the asymptomatic or less symptomatic people at home, where there's a false negative matters more.
Dr. Sampath-Kumar, what are you hearing about the rate of false negatives coming from these kinds of tests?
We know that no test is perfect, and generally most tests do have some level of false negative tests. This has sort of become more striking with COVID because we are seeing patients who present with very classic symptoms and radiographic x-ray evidence of COVID, and they are testing negative. And because we don't believe that they don't have COVID, we're retesting them and are finding positives on our subsequent testing. And then in people who don't have a lot of symptoms, it's more likely that we're missing some cases because they don't have as much virus, the test doesn't pick it up. So it's hard to know how many false negatives we have, but we suspect that we are seeing some.
This is sort of complicated because a lot of these tests were created by state labs, different labs. under what's known as an emergency use authorization from the FDA. So we're not talking about one standard test. And I guess I'm wondering, Dr. Sampathkumar, are we seeing false negatives because we have varied tests or because people are getting samples collected at early times when they don't have a big viral load? What's behind this?
It's probably a combination of all of those. So at my institution, all the tests are done by the same lab, which is our in-house lab. So the test variation isn't a problem for us. But collecting a nasopharyngeal swab can be a problematic. Patients have to cooperate for you to insert the swab, get to the back of the throat.
Yeah, I had one. It's really like you're going up to someone's brain.
Yes, it does feel like that. So getting the sample can be tricky. The other thing is the virus we think is in highest levels in the upper airway in the early part of the disease. So if you're testing someone who's had symptoms for a while, it could be that the nasopharyngeal swab is not the best sample. Maybe we should be getting samples from lower down in the respiratory tract, like the lungs. Then how it's transported to the lab, how long it takes to get to the lab can also play into the false negative issue.
Dr. Ofri, what has your experience been like with performing these tests? And I guess when you see them at Bellevue, has there been a learning curve for administering them correctly?
Yes, if you haven't been comfortable sticking a swab way, way in, I think people in the beginning are a little bit gun-shy and maybe are doing nasal swabs instead of nasopharyngeal swabs. Again, if the viral load is high, it's not a problem. But if the viral load is not as high, you may not get it there. But again, you know, when we measured sensitivity and specificity, that's based on a gold standard of diagnosis, and we don't yet have that. So all these numbers that we hear about, it's really hard to interpret them because we, you know, normally, for example, we, in another disease, we may do it against a biopsy where we can see the, you know, the infectious agent, but here we don't have that. So the numbers vary quite a bit. Is it 65% sensitive, 75%? We really don't know because we don't have a gold standard.
Yeah, I guess I'm thinking, Dr. Ofri, of something like, say, breast cancer, where if you get a mammogram that's just a little bit concerning, they immediately have you back for another one. And a false negative is not as big a deal in a scenario like that. I guess I wonder how that compares to a scenario where we're concerned about transmission here.
Again, it depends which setting. In the inpatient setting at this point, if they have the symptoms, they have COVID no matter what the test shows, and the test, in essence, is less relevant. It's really relevant as an outpatient, and particularly for people who live in homes with more than one person. If you live alone and you have symptoms, we just tell you to isolate no matter what the test says. But what if you live in a family of five? To self-isolate with a family, especially if you have small children, is very hard. So telling someone to do that when they don't have it is quite a burden. And not having them do that when they do have the disease is also concerning because they can transmit the illness to other family members.
Does avoiding contamination worry you at all when you're juggling a lot of patients and tests? Or is that kind of moot because at Bellevue, the people you're seeing are very sick?
In the inpatient, you're usually doing one person at a time. In the outpatient, in the beginning, we were doing two separate tests for flu and for COVID. So two different swabs, two different vials, and we were cohorting family. So I had several situations of two patients, each with two tubes. So it's four tubes, four swabs, all in one room, everyone masked. And so it was a little complicated, and I worried about mixing them up. And, of course, the print on the labels is very small, and you've got a mask on, and it's in bags. And so we had to be very careful. But I think now we're more streamlined. It's one swab for everything and one patient at a time. So it's, in fact, easier. And I think it's no more an issue than any other lab test that we do.
Dr. Sampathkumar, when we're talking about PCR tests, polymerase chain reaction tests, they are sort of the gold standard for a lot of things, for flu, for HIV. Is there any data that coronavirus PCR tests produce more false negative than other widely used PCRs, or am I kind of off on a tangent?
So as Daniel was saying, there's very little information on what the rate of false negative tests is. So for coronavirus, the answer is no. Other similar kinds of tests have similar issues. So the influenza PCR, for instance, is also not perfect. we have learned to sort of live with some degree of uncertainty. You know, it's important to take the whole context into consideration. So like Dr. Ofri was saying, if the patient has definite symptoms and is ill enough to be hospitalized, the negative test doesn't mean the patient doesn't have COVID. But I think that we're probably going to be using the same kind of technology going forward.
I'd like to ask you about antibody tests and sort of the possibility of using them as a detection tool when we think about them from a public health standpoint. How long do they take and how accurate are they compared to a PCR test for coronavirus?
The problem with using an antibody test for diagnosis is that it takes several days. We think somewhere on the order of about 10 days for the antibodies to first appear in the blood after you've had COVID infection. So it's not going to be very helpful to diagnose an infection. It will be very useful from the public health standpoint to see what proportion of a population that you're studying has already had the infection.
Dr. Ofri, knowing that there is this chance of false negative, in a clinical setting, how are you treating patients now? And I guess, how will you be treating patients if New York hopefully sort of gets to this place where maybe some of the people you see are a little less sick than some of the incredibly ill people coming to the hospital?
For patients who have symptoms, if you have a cough, a fever, or you're short of breath, or loss of taste and smell, or sore throat at this point, we're treating as COVID no matter what the test says. And so we advise them to isolate for at least 7 days and at least 3 days without symptoms before venturing out. If someone has no symptoms, but let's say had an exposure, that's a trickier situation. Because again, those recommendations can be quite onerous.
Yeah.
And so again, it depends on what their exposure has been. If, you know, a coworker three offices over was diagnosed positive, that's not such a big deal. If they're a healthcare worker working in a hot zone, we consider it much more likely, even if the test is negative, and they might want to isolate for a week before they return back to work.
Dr. Sampath Kumar, when we think about the other side of the curve and hopefully getting there, are there things that doctors and sort of healthcare systems should be doing to ensure that false negatives don't contribute to the greater spread of the virus and maybe that curve inching up again?
The false negatives become more significant when you have limited cases in the community. That's when knowing what the false negative rate is would be very helpful. What we need to continue to do is all the common sense things, what we call standard precautions in healthcare. When you're seeing a patient who you have contact with their secretions, make sure you're wearing gloves, wearing eye protection and a mask. In the social setting, make sure you continue to do social distancing and cover your cough when you're coughing or having any symptoms.
Dr. Priya Sampath Kumar is the Medical Director of Infection Prevention and Control at the Mayo Clinic, and Dr. Danielle Ofri is an attending physician at Bellevue Hospital and author of the forthcoming book, When We Do Harm, A Doctor Confronts Medical Error. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We asked you to share your experience with coronavirus testing by calling us at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Arlene from Tampa, Florida. Back in March, I had symptoms that could have been the coronavirus, but there weren't any tests available. Now I'd like to know whether I actually had it or not. They were pretty mild, but I had it for about 3 weeks where I was running a fever and cough and feeling very fatigued. I did stay home and self-quarantine. I have been at home since then.
Hi, this is Marina Abbott calling from Sonoma, California. And I was able to get tested last Monday after returning from Spain. I do have a pre-existing condition and had some minor symptoms that could have been COVID. Luckily, I tested negative.
Hi, this is Will from St. Paul. I've had two friends who were diagnosed via telehealth, but were not able to actually get tested. They were told to come back if their lips or fingers turned blue, otherwise to just stay home.
Thanks for your stories, and we always want to hear from you at 877-8-MY-TAKE. As the number of people being hospitalized for COVID-19 continues to rise, there are concerns that some vulnerable people may not be able to get the care they need. A new investigation from the Center for Public Integrity shows that people with disabilities may not be able to access ventilators amid the pandemic. The investigation analyzed policies and guidelines from 30 states to see how people with disabilities would be treated if ventilators had to be rationed. And in all but five states, they found provisions that may give people with disabilities a lower priority than other patients. The remaining states either had no policies or didn't release them. In a few minutes, we'll hear from a disability advocate who's been fighting these policies in her own state. But first, I spoke with Liz Esley White about her investigation. She's an investigative reporter at the Center for Public Integrity, and I first asked her what these policies actually do in the 30 states she's looked at.
In about 14 states, the policies singled out specific diagnoses and said, you know, if you have one of these, you're less likely to receive a ventilator if we run out. So that's things like cystic fibrosis or dementia or even baseline functional status, which is a very broad consideration. And then 13 states say, you know, if you need assistance with activities of daily living or more resources, we would also deprioritize you. And then there's six states that if you have a ventilator and you use it in your daily life, which many people with disabilities do, if you come to the hospital as an acute care patient, then the state ethically can take away your ventilator if they need it. And then there are also 16 states where they took into account not just immediate survival of whether the patient can get better from coronavirus or whatever disease they're getting treated for, but long-term, how long are they expected to live?
Some states had particularly discriminatory policies. Washington, for example. Can you walk through that example and sort of show us what it means on a practical basis?
So it took into account baseline functional status, which includes something called cognition, very broad and could mean all kinds of things. Basically, if you have an intellectual disability, there is a fear that you are therefore put down in the list of the people that Washington would be willing to save if they run out of ventilators. And the policy explicitly said to look at loss of reserves and energy, physical ability, cognition, and general health. And you're just looking at things that may be really irrelevant to whether someone can recover from coronavirus. If someone is paralyzed, does that count as physical ability that they don't have, that they would therefore be at the back of the line for a ventilator? I mean, it raises a lot of questions.
How are states legally able to have these kinds of provisions? I mean, the ADA has been in place for 30 years. I'm a little bit surprised by this, frankly.
There's always a judgment that doctors are making when they're making medical futility decisions about whether a treatment will actually help someone get better or whether it is, you know, not going to do anything for them. But in a pandemic, in a crisis standards of care situation, you're weighing someone's likelihood of survival against someone else's likelihood of survival. But I would be surprised if we don't see some sort of litigation or kind of decisions by the courts on these types of policies and how they relate to the Americans with Disabilities Act.
One thing I think it would be helpful to have you explain is why disability advocates find it so problematic to look at lifespans and what factors people should be looking at instead.
There's general agreement that if you look at just long-term life expectancy, that can be really discriminatory, not only to people with disabilities, but even African-American men who on average are not expected to live as long as other people. Some of the policies just blanket say, you know, look at life expectancy, but others are more careful in how they do that. So they might look at, you know, is this person going to live five more years? Is this person going to live one more year? Is this person going to live six more months? But some of those are really worrisome to advocates of people with disabilities because so many people with disabilities have been told, we only expect you to live six more months, or we only expect you to live two more years, and here they are 20 years later. And then there's also, you know, misperceptions about quality of life that come into those kind of predictions. The National Council on Disability had a study out in the last year that showed that many healthcare providers may deem treatment futile or non-beneficial to a person with disabilities. And if you look back later on, these people are living a long and healthy and happy life.
What is the federal government's role in all of this? And has the Department of Health and Human Services responded to these various statewide rules at all?
Advocates with Disabilities have filed complaints in 4 states, and the Health and Human Services Office of Civil Rights came out at the end of March and said, you cannot, as a state, have a policy on ventilator rationing that discriminates against people with disability. So they started by looking at Alabama's policy, and Alabama had said, if you are someone with severe mental retardation, you would be lower priority for a ventilator. Alabama, you know, a week later disavowed that policy, got rid of it, scrubbed it from its websites, which had been up very recently. So HHS closed the case, but it sounds like HHS may have a bunch of other investigations on its hands just based on the complaints that they have left from disability advocates. There have been calls from other groups who have studied this over the years back, you know, after H1N1 happened, that the federal government should take a role in promulgating national standards. There is a little bit of that that has gone on. HHS has kind of a repository of documents that ethicists and medical experts can look at when they're designing their own standards. But there's no federal standard. There's not even 50 state standards. So,
yeah, we spoke on this show to a professor of critical care medicine at the University of Pittsburgh, and he was telling us about new ethical guidelines that they've developed for hospitals to try to combat this kind of discrimination. And I want to play you that clip.
They recommended simply excluding from access to ICU care patients with certain characteristics, for example, those with advanced age, those with severe heart and lung problems. And we viewed those to be, frankly, just discriminatory features of the guidelines. And so we set out to develop a very different approach. Rather than excluding patients from ICU care, all patients who are normally eligible for ICU care remain eligible. And priority is given according to the likelihood that an individual will benefit, as defined by their likelihood of surviving to hospital discharge and beyond, according to objective measures.
Absent federal guidance, do you think hospitals can fight these kind of bias issues on their own?
There are some states like Massachusetts that just came out with this policy that have explicitly said up front, you know, we do not want to discriminate against people with disabilities. We're not doing that in this policy. We refuse to do that. But then advocates are kind of coming back and saying, okay, that's great to kind of say that in a blanket statement, but can you please put that into actual step-by-step instructions for doctors and hospitals and how not to do that? Because it's one thing for you to say, we're not going to discriminate, but then, you know, your policy is vague or it's just not really helpful for hospitals to figure out how else do you decide to ration ventilators then. I think there will be movement on that as more and more states kind of figure out how to actually implement that.
Liz Esley-White is an investigative reporter at the Center for Public Integrity. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Lizzie.
We just heard new reporting on state policies that could make it harder for people with disabilities to get ventilators during this COVID-19 crisis. Now, here's someone organizing to fight those policies.
We signed a complaint to the Office of Civil Rights that this would be a violation of the ADA because you cannot discriminate based on disability and age. And so you are in violation of the ADA if you use these guidelines.
Ivanova Smith is a disability advocate in Tacoma, Washington. She has an intellectual disability and is part of a group that filed a complaint with the state over their guidelines around rationing care during this pandemic. But Ivanova told us that discrimination against individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities, or IDDs, isn't unique to this crisis. She says she often faces discrimination when she goes to the doctor without her husband.
A lot of people that have had similar experiences, and I know a lot of people that have had worse experience than myself, like they got full treatment denied, or like they get denied an organ transplant, or people are in very critical care and the hospital doesn't want to take them to the ICU. And they just say, well, they're not really doing much in their life, especially people that are nonverbal and people who have a lot of medical fragility. They see it as like, oh, if they get sick, then there's nothing we can do, they feel like. And it's like, yeah, you can still try to save their life, and their life is still worth value. Nobody's life is worthless. And when we talk about rationing and doing it based on disability or age or anything like that, that goes into really hairy territory, and I think we should stay out of that territory.
Under the current policies, Ivanova told us she's worried about losing members of her own community to COVID-19.
I worry that a lot of my community members will die, because several of my community members have died from getting lack of medical care, even in the other medical issues. So we've had some deaths already. And so my community and I were really mourning the passing of these people. And one thing we've been doing is really connecting online through Zoom. We started a self-advocate speaking freely Zoom group on our Facebook where we just talk and hang out. And there's times we've actually had to host memorials. We've actually had to host a memorial for a local people first member who passed away. She was a really good friend, and she had a lot of heart, and she didn't deserve to die. She, you know, she was still, I believe she was in her, 40s, and I don't understand that I was in shock when I found out, and it just makes this action that more important, that we try to stop this as much as possible, because it's already happening. It's already happening to our members, and it's already happening to the self-advocate community nationally.
She also told us that the way states and hospitals are approaching patients during COVID-19 reminds many of a traumatic history.
There's a long history of eugenics when it comes to medical care for people with disabilities. So I think people should keep that in mind in the back of their heads, that we should not let eugenics creep back into our society. We should call out eugenics when we see it. And I see this as a clear eugenics trying to sneak its way back in, and we got to stomp it out immediately.
And beyond just fighting against discriminatory policies, Ivanova says there are ways to push for change.
But we need to prevent this from happening. We need to get trainings for the triage teams on equity for people with disabilities and the value of people with disabilities. We need to get the people who are overseeing these decisions, the leaders, the board members, that the people with IDD can be representative in these meetings. I think the people that are most impacted by these type of vaccinating decisions should be at the table to decide what happens. We're human beings, and we contribute to our communities. We contribute to our societies, and we deserve equal understanding.
Ivanova Smith is a disability advocate in Tacoma, Washington. So professional sports may be on hiatus, but that doesn't mean that there's not news coming from the sports world right now. This Friday, ESPN will host the WNBA draft on their main channel for the first time. The draft will be in virtual format due to the coronavirus pandemic. Before the coronavirus hit, 2020 was shaping up to be an historic year for the women's league and for women's basketball as a whole. The momentum began with a collective bargaining agreement that increased athletes' salaries, requiring every team in the league to offer fully paid maternity leave to its players and more. The untimely deaths of Kobe and Gigi Bryant also placed more attention on women's basketball. Gigi was a rising star in the sport with her dad's support. And fans and players are hoping that this momentum continues, despite the halt coronavirus has put on sports. Maria Marino joined me to talk about this. She's a TV host, anchor, and UConn women's basketball reporter for SNY. We also spoke with Howard Megdal. He's the editor and founder of the 9 newsletter and High Post Hoops. I asked Howard to tell us what makes this collective bargaining agreement historic.
It is a change in the paradigm for how women's basketball players are employed in this country. Previously, WNBA players would play in the league and would play overseas, and overseas was the priority. And that was in part because the money was significantly larger overseas than it was here. This new collective bargaining agreement does two things. One, it increases the amount of compensation that the players are getting here, but it also introduces penalties for players not being in camp for the start of training camp, which means a need to prioritize accordingly. So both sides win from what is a huge investment in the players over the long term.
Maria, did you think it was a good deal, or is this sort of a starting point?
I think it's definitely a starting point. However, it is an absolutely a great starting point and a great deal. I think that the players now will be garnering more respect and more benefits, also higher pay than ever before. And I truly believe that investment in the players and making that a priority is overall going to help the WNBA product, which will then help its popularity.
Well, you mentioned popularity. Maria, let's kind of put that in context a little bit, both how the WNBA has been seen and treated by the media, the public, and then what seems to be a little bit of a recent uptick in interest.
Well, there have always been some stigmas, I think, involved with the WNBA for whatever reason. And I think part of it is just the fact that women's sports in general tend to receive less funding, fewer resources, and less media coverage. However, I think that has been improving over recent years. And there were certainly signs ahead of this year, such as the 2019 NCAA tournament. The women's Final Four saw its highest attendance in 15 years. And of course, that's the direct feeder system into the WNBA. But 2020 really came out strong. Howard mentioned the groundbreaking new collective bargaining agreement. And then from there, it's been an interesting turn of events. I think, unfortunately, the deaths of Kobe Bryant and his daughter Gianna, which were extremely tragic and just altogether a massive blow to basketball in general, but also women's in particular, did put the women's game somewhat at the forefront of the conversation. For instance, so many people just watching the memorial ceremony for Kobe and Gigi, and you saw all-time leading scorer of the WNBA, Diana Taurasi, 11-time national champ for the UConn women's team, Gina Auriemma, and college star Sabrina Ionescu. They were all speaking, and that brings me to probably the culmination of the driver lately of higher attendance, ratings, media coverage, and that is Sabrina, who's projected to be the first overall pick in the draft to the New York Liberty.
Well, what does all of this mean now that coronavirus is upending so much in sports, not just the WNBA? Howard, what does this mean for kind of what happens now and the new collective bargaining agreement?
You know, so much of that is unknown in the same way that it's unknown around sports. And Maria made a great point that there was this real driver of popularity in Sabrina Ionescu, who is about to come to New York. But exactly when she's going to make that debut, it was originally going to be in the middle of May. And now that date is unknown, with the WNBA having to push things back. The idea across the board is that this investment isn't necessarily going away, but that there's a delay to it. But of course, with so many of us knowing so little about the shape of this outbreak, how long it's going to last, and how much money will be lost along the way, it's really difficult to get a sense of exactly what that recovery looks like and whether there be any change to what was clearly shaping up to be the most important year women's basketball had had so far.
How does the draft play into this? Because that's going to be aired on ESPN's main channel on Friday. That seems like it's potentially a pretty big deal for the league. Howard?
It's an opportunity for any number of teams to not only fill needs, but for the league as a whole to be front and center. During the time that, and Maria spoke about this, and it's absolutely true, that there's a disproportionate lack of coverage of women's sports in the WNBA, even relative to any gaps you see in terms of attendance, in terms of ratings, that the WNBA still doesn't get as much media coverage as even that would dictate before you take investment into it. But this Friday night, the WNBA will be front and center. It'll be on ESPN. It will be the live sporting event that everyone who wants one is going to get a chance to see. And so that's also an introduction to some of the league's next biggest stars, whether it's Sabrina Ionescu going to New York, whether it's players like Kennedy Carter or Satu Sabally from Oregon as well, or even Lauren Koch from Baylor.
Maria, do you think there's something to be gained from this moment, I guess, where a lot of people are sitting at home and the draft is going to be live on TV?
Absolutely. It's imperative for the W to continue to stay relevant and build on the momentum that they've had all year. And it was a little upsetting when it was first announced that the draft would be broadcast virtually via ESPN2 as opposed to the main network. Now, they did move it over to ESPN. And I would say that Sabrina Ionescu was not the reason they moved it over, even though she called it out on social media and said, hey, why isn't this on ESPN? But I think she was the reason that they couldn't not change it over to ESPN, because it begged this question. Well, if we have such a shortage of live sporting events right now, why wouldn't this be on the main network? And I think that speaks to a greater issue that women's sports have been facing for so long, where media gatekeepers in many ways and decision makers have been so used to doing things one way and don't necessarily think to change it unless there's someone fighting for that change.
Does any of that change, I guess, with the popularity of other women's sports? I mean, I think obviously of the, you know, women's soccer team in the U.S. Does seeing them win so much maybe put some pressure, Howard, on media gatekeepers to say, oh, you know what, let's turn our cameras on other sports?
I think it does exactly what you said. And Maria spoke about this, and it's really true. There is this default that men are at the center, and we're defining everything that women do relative to what men are doing. We see that across lots of industries, but certainly in sports media. And it almost felt like it had reached that logical extreme when ESPN had initially announced that the draft would be on ESPN2 when there's literally nothing that could have taken precedent over it on ESPN. And it's sort of ridiculous. And it also speaks to Sabrina Ionescu's platform, that she was able to speak out about this, and hopefully that played a part in not only getting this change, but reinforcing to people that there's going to be accountability, that there are going to be people who are going to take leagues and media entities to task for not treating the women's game with that level of respect. And I absolutely believe that the national soccer team and the success they have had and the ratings that they have had as well, and the level of interest that comes from it, has led other women's sports. I know this for a fact, that the WNBA has seen it and said, here's an opportunity for us to do much the same thing.
Maria, how much do you worry about the pause, I guess, this moment where we're not seeing live sports, where we don't know what's going to happen next? You know, if there was a groundswell of interest in the WNBA, what happens now? And do you worry the moment could be squandered?
I started out being deeply worried by the events of the coronavirus and the effects on cancellations. I mean, we were already sort of robbed of the NCAA tournament, and I think what would have been an epic culmination to a historic college career for someone like Sabrina Ionescu. And it's not just women's sports, it's all sports. But because of what I mentioned previously about women's sports being somewhat behind as far as that level of respect and that attention, it definitely made me concerned. But what I've come to realize is that I truly think that some of these things going on in women's sports are just undeniable. I think the fans are passionate enough that they will stay tuned and they will stay with this no matter what. And I also think there are many admirable people in media, in business, that do believe in the women's product and that will continue that fight regardless. So there's certainly concerns. There's concerns across the board in sports. And the women's game will continue to make strides, and the time will come for the attention to be where it needs to be.
Maria Marino is a TV host, anchor, and UConn women's basketball reporter for SNY. And Howard Magdal is the editor and founder of The Nine newsletter and High Post Hoops. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Coronavirus has placed the production of many movies and TV series on hold for the moment. But work is still being done on certain projects that had already finished filming. So today, we're wrapping up the hour by talking with someone who's overseeing the completion of a new series, from her home.
My name is Davi Waller. I'm the creator and showrunner of Mrs. America.
Davi's show looks back at a turning point for the women's rights movement of the 20th century. And while prominent feminists like Gloria Steinem and Shirley Chisholm are important figures on the show, the central character is conservative activist Phyllis Schlafly, who amassed grassroots support in the 1970s to halt the ratification of the Equal Rights Amendment. Here she is in 1975 on The Phil Donahue Show.
Now, I think all of these careers are open to women, but you're telling our young women a very false thing if you teach them that that anything else is preferable to being in the home. You're telling them a wrong thing if you teach them that the home is some kind of prison and that marriage is slavery and that the wife is just kind of a glorified prostitute. You're teaching them a false thing if you try to lure them away from that and tell them that there's more fulfillment elsewhere. Now, if they want it, it's okay. Nobody's stopping them.
And here's actor Cate Blanchett, striking a similar tone while playing Schlafly in Mrs. America.
Let me be clear. I am not against women succeeding. I am not against women working outside the home. That's their choice. But what I am against is a small, elitist group of Northeastern establishment liberals putting down homemakers.
For Davi Waller, understanding Schlafly's activism is an essential lesson for today's women's movements.
The more I studied history and the more I looked into Phyllis Schlafly and this counter movement that she put forth, I saw this interesting pattern where every time we take a step forward and there's a social revolution, there's always a counter revolution, there's always a backlash. And if we don't really understand the roots of the backlash, I don't think our social revolutions will be very successful.
I asked Davi to explain how Schlafly was able to turn momentum against the ERA.
No one was against equal rights for women being put into the Constitution. What Phyllis did was she made the issue controversial. And once a constitutional amendment becomes controversial, it becomes very, very hard to get it ratified. And if it doesn't get ratified within the first 2 years of coming out of Congress, it is almost impossible to get it in the Constitution. I mean, there's an effort right now to get it in the Constitution. Last three states ratified within the last 3 years, so we'll see. But traditionally, that is the pattern of constitutional amendments. So she made something that was not controversial controversial, and that's when the problems began.
There are these little moments in the show where you show her experiencing sexism, harassment, you know, asked to take notes in a meeting full of men. What were you thinking about when you decided to show her experiencing that stuff as well, and you know, those little moments of pain on her face?
Well, mostly came out of a desire to be accurate to the time. So we all know there's no way that she lived through the times that she did and never experienced sexism. And even though she herself said she was never discriminated against, we wanted to interrogate that. She, especially since her passion, defense strategy, nuclear policy, that was a man's world back then and probably even now. So it just felt dishonest to not include any sexism in her world. That felt like a completely dishonest view of the history. At the same time, we were more interested not in the very overt ways, because if she was someone who said, I don't believe I've ever been discriminated against, then part of that is some cognitive dissonance on her part, but part of that is also that sexism and discrimination, there's so many nuanced ways in which it comes through. And I think we're interested in the more subtle ways where no one's saying to her, you're not getting this job or you're not getting this position because you're a lady. They do it by sending her out of the room when they start talking about important things.
Well, and there is a sort of comfort to the sexism and the discrimination in the world that she lives in. It is a wealthy world. She has a maid. It's very easy to notice that all of the women in her world are white. And, you know, I guess I wonder how much in this series you were setting out to show the insidious effects of that on women and how women can be lulled into complacency by wealth and by comfort.
That was absolutely at the forefront of our minds when we were, when the writers and I were breaking the stories for every episode. It was not lost on us that many of the homemakers in her army were middle class or upper middle class, And they had the luxury, you know, being able to be a stay-at-home wife and mother is a luxury. Most women are working women. Most women have to work to support their families along with their partners. So her entire organization just ignored that fact. That, and so we wanted to include that. You know, Willie B. Reed, who was her cook, had to work. She also had a child at home, but she couldn't afford to stay home. So that very much was part of the tapestry of the show, that both sides in some ways ignored working class women and the plight of working class women. Not entirely. Gloria Steinem talks about this a lot, but it was definitely leaders on both sides were middle class, upper middle class. And this is an issue that we still face today, that the intersection of race and class with women's issues is not something that's always addressed to the full extent that it should be.
This show is coming out at a time when a lot of productions are on hold, or even productions that have finished filming, you know, people are scrambling to try to make the final tweaks. What's it been like to try to get this out the door as this massive pandemic was, you know, kind of creeping across the world?
I mean, Lizzie, it's been a total nightmare. I mean, I'm so glad you asked that, because I would just love to give a shout out to our unbelievable post-production team. You know, we were in the middle of locking. We hadn't quite locked picture in the finale when the shelter-in-place order came in. We're still in the middle of mixing the last three episodes. And within a day, everyone was remote. All the editors were up and running remotely. Our sound mixers have been working through this pandemic without, I've never heard one complaint. We have not missed our deadlines. And, you know, I actually just spoke to Scott Gershon, who does all our sound design, and he got a call from Netflix, and they're like, how are you doing it? So I'm really happy that we can, like, lead the way in how you accomplish post-production during a pandemic. I just feel really lucky to have one of the most incredible and dedicated teams. But knock on wood, we've been pulling it off. We'll see if those last three make it, but I think they will.
You know, you theoretically have younger women, younger political activists sitting in their living rooms watching this show. Are there things that you want them to take away from this and apply to 2020?
I would say never be complacent. You know, I think I was lulled, you know, as raised a feminist, until you really rise through the ranks, it feels like the world is pretty equal. And I think we all got a little lulled into thinking we were in this post-feminist world and a woman could be president. And that, I think, was a mistake. So I would just say never get complacent. Keep fighting. The things that are worth fighting for all the time, even when you think you're winning, even when you think it's around the corner. You have to keep fighting.
Davi Waller is the creator and executive producer of Mrs. America. Thank you so much for your time.
Oh, it was so fun to talk to you. Thanks, Lizzie.
All right, that's our show for today. Thank you so much for listening. As always, you can call in and share your thoughts with us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Or share them with us on Twitter. We're at The Takeaway. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, filling in for Tanzina Vega. And you can find me on Twitter at Lizzie O'Reilly. Thanks so much for listening. This is The Takeaway. Talk to you tomorrow.